Welcome. We begin chapter 17 this evening in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, a chapter titled The Soul and Nature, first appeared in the journal Arya on the 15th of April, 1917. The Soul and Nature, Purusha and Prakriti. The article which came directly after this in the Arya was one of the essays on the Gita entitled Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. So this was much on Sri Aurobindo's mind. This chapter has been revised to some extent. This first paragraph was revised around 1932, we think, and later paragraphs were revised even earlier than that, somewhere, we guess, in the 1920s. It's all been brought together here by the archival staff in a way that those treatments don't overlap or interfere with each other. No editorial decisions have been made which were destructive to the intent of Sri Aurobindo. So, having said that, chapter 17, The Soul and Nature. This is the result of the integral knowledge taken in its mass. Its work is to gather up the different strands of our being into the universal oneness. This is interesting that he uses the term strand, because that is a translation of the term guna. So the gunas are the three strands, and here he's talking about bringing them into a universal oneness which goes beyond nature, based on a knowledge that integrates, that makes one. If we are to possess perfectly the world in our new divinized consciousness, as the divine himself possesses it, we have to know also each thing in its absoluteness. First, by itself. Secondly, in its union with all that completes it. For so has the divine imaged out and seen its being in the world. So we have here, again, references to the three terms of real being: what you are in your essence, what you are individually, and how you connect with all else. But also, how has the divine imaged it out? He's presented it for vision, and then he sees it as being in the world. So this is a way, again, of bringing to the idea that the divine being makes itself manifest, makes itself clear to the view, strikes off the covering, and says, "Here I am," and does so stationed in the individual, abroad throughout the whole of the cosmos, but always placed in essential being, beyond the conditions of time and space. This idea that it is seen comes back to the term darshana, which is vision. Indian philosophies, I think, are rightly understood to be based upon vision. And the greatest philosophies are those which have the deepest and the widest vision. As in science, we laud the theories that are the most comprehensive. To the Indian spirit, it is the one who sees to the utter depths that is the Rishi. That person is the seer, not merely a student, not merely a person who's really smart, but somebody who can gauge reality. It takes vision to see that. Sri Aurobindo here continues to say, to see things as parts, as incomplete elements, is a lower analytic knowledge. And this, of course, is what the mind does. It is typically divisive, and it is spirit that heals division. Sri Aurobindo is here writing in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge because we're looking at that which unites, at that state of connectedness, yukta. But so to know the world, so to perceive and experience it, it is not enough to have an intellectual idea or imagination that so it is. A certain divine vision, divine sense, divine ecstasy is needed, an experience of union of ourselves with the objects of our consciousness. This comes back to the fundamental poise of the divine awareness, which, out of its singleness, can at once be the object to its own view and the subject viewing. This is the miraculous, comprehensive, all-in-one vision of the supramental as it renders Satchit Ananta into full display, takes its infinity, and begins to measure it out. Sri Aurobindo, as you'll remember in reading The Life Divine, acknowledges the role that intelligence plays in establishing a philosophy, understands the importance of logic, but primarily, again, says that it is the seer, the one who has the vision based upon his experience. That is the final arbiter of truth. Do you know it by identity? He founds his philosophy on this, that the best knowledge, real knowledge, is the experience of identity, where subject and object become one, the distance is closed, distinction, differentiation need not vanish, but division must evaporate. In that experience, not only the beyond, but all here, not only the totality, the all in its mass, but each thing in the all becomes to us, ourself, God, the absolute and infinite, Satchit Ananda. So again, this was a revelatory experience that he had in 1909 when he was in the Alipur jail, but multiplied over the years. And here he speaks of the beyond, of the all, of the individual, the transcendent, the universal, the individual, the three terms of being. Why have a universe? Why would the soul dwell in it if not to recapture what the divine's experience is, to make particular and minute what it feels and experiences on a grand scale, on an essential scale. So this is the larger goal of yoga. He continues, this is the secret of complete delight in God's world, complete satisfaction of the mind and heart and will, complete liberation of the consciousness. Purnam, purnam madaha, purnam minam. That is full, ever full. It is impossible to exhaust the infinite transcendent. This, too, is filled with the presence of that infinity. It, too, is inexhaustible. The farther you go into it, the more you find that there. Exploration is endless. It is the supreme experience at which art and poetry and all the various efforts of subjective and objective knowledge and all desire and effort to possess and enjoy objects are trying more or less obscurely to arrive. Their attempt to seize the forms and properties and qualities of things is only a first movement which cannot give the deep satisfaction unless, by seizing them perfectly and absolutely, they get the sense of the infinite reality of which these are the outer symbols. Because that being, that soul existent, is present in each minute thing. So, the experience truly of anything can be apocalyptic, can open you to the experience of the whole, to that from which the whole comes. To the rational mind and the ordinary sense experience, this may well seem only a poetic fancy or a mystic hallucination, but the absolute satisfaction and sense of illumination which it gives and alone can give is really a proof of its greater validity. We get by that a ray from the higher consciousness and the diviner sense into which our subjective being is intended eventually, if we will only allow it, to be transfigured. So this aesthetic experience that he describes can indeed be an apocalypse of the divine. This is the fruit of an integral yoga. We have seen that this applies to the highest principles of the divine being. Ordinarily, the discriminating mind tells us that only what is beyond all manifestation is absolute. Only the formless spirit is infinite. Only the timeless, spaceless, immutable, immobile self in its repose is absolutely real. This, of course, is the Atman, abstract from the universe. This is that which transcends. And if we follow and are governed in our endeavor by this conception, that is the subjective experience at which we shall arrive. All else seeming to us false or only relatively true. But if we start from the larger conception, a completer truth and a wider experience open to us, we perceive that the immutability of the timeless, spaceless existence is an absolute and an infinite, but that also the conscious force and the active delight of the divine being in its all blissful possession of the outpouring of its powers, qualities, self-creations is an absolute and an infinite. And indeed, the same absolute and infinite, so much the same that we can enjoy simultaneously, equally, the divine timeless calm and peace and the divine time-possessing joy of activity freely, infinitely, without bondage or the lapse into unrest and suffering. So too, we can have the same experience of all the principles of this activity, which, in the immutable, are self-contained and in a sense drawn in and concealed in the cosmic, are expressed and realize their infinite quality and capacity. So here again, he has gone beyond his first liberating experience in 1908, where he settled into Brahmic Nirvana, or rather it settled into him. And here he's challenging us to meet existence as conscious power, chit shakti. Sat should become chit shakti. And the active delight of that, the ananda of that, is the reason, the raison d'etre of the play. And here at the end, of course, we meet what is no longer concealed, what is thrown out into open display. That is the manifestation. Not a creation, ex nihilo, but a manifestation of its own being. So, this is how he sets it up to begin. Now, the first of these principles in importance is the duality, which resolves itself into a unity of Purusha and Prakriti, of which we have had occasion to speak in the Yoga of Works. Of course, we're going back to the Sankhya philosophy here, not that of the Sankhya Karikas, which is a much later development, but the original penetrating insight, which we attribute to the sage Kapila, who must have lived several hundred years before the Common Era. And is honored by all traditions to this extent, that the language which he might have originated in terms of the enumeration of the world's nature, Sankhya means enumeration, the fruitful dialectic between Purusha and Prakriti is part and parcel of his vocabulary. The gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas, arise from this. And there is no Indian philosophy that does not make use of these terms, even if they are nihilistic, even if they are based in Advaita Vedanta. This terminology, based in this dualistic view of soul being separate from nature, is fundamental. Sri Aurobindo here will use the language in his own way, and he begins by saying that this pair resolves into a unity. What we can say about Kapila is that getting free of the entanglements of the mind, of the emotions, of the physical sensations that claim our attention, is merely to step back into our deeper consciousness and witness, to see, and our most intimate thoughts, our most precious emotions, the continuance of our precious body. All of these things are not what we are in our essence. And if we will sit in that consciousness in which we are the witness and simply see nature for what it is, in that moment we become free. So, we continue. This division was made most clearly by the old Indian philosophies, but it bases itself upon the eternal fact of practical duality in unity, upon which the world manifestation is founded. It is given different names according to our view of the universe. The Vedantins spoke of the self and Maya, meaning, according to their predilections, by the self, the immutable, and by Maya, the power the self has of imposing on itself the cosmic illusion, or by the self, the divine being, and by Maya, the nature of conscious being and the conscious force by which the divine embodies himself in soul forms and forms of things. Others spoke of Ishvara and Shakti, the Lord and his force, his cosmic power. The analytic philosophy of the Sankhyas affirmed their eternal duality without any possibility of oneness, accepting only relations of union and separation by which the cosmic action of Prakriti begins, proceeds, or ceases for the Purusha. For the Purusha is an inactive conscious existence. It is the soul, the same in itself and immutable forever. Prakriti, the active force of nature, which by its motion creates and contains and by its sinking into rest dissolves the phenomenon of the cosmos. So this is the typical description of the Sankhya philosophy. Note that Sri Aurobindo here regards the cosmos as a phenomenon in the singular, because however multifarious it may be, it is still one entity, not divided, not segmented. Leaving aside these philosophical distinctions, we come to the original psychological experience from which all really take their start, that there are two elements in the existence of living beings, of human beings, at least if not of all cosmos, a dual being, nature and the soul. This duality is self-evident, without any philosophy at all, by the mere force of experience. It is what we can all perceive, although we may not take the trouble to define. Even the most thoroughgoing materialism, which denies the soul or resolves it into a more or less illusory result of natural phenomena acting upon some ill-explained phenomenon of the physical brain, which we call consciousness or the mind, but which is really no more than a sort of complexity of nervous spasms, cannot get rid of the practical fact of this duality. He's having a bit of fun with the epiphenomena of Locke here. It does not matter at all how it came about. The fact is not only there, it determines our whole existence. It is the one fact which is really important to us as human beings with a will and an intelligence and a subjective existence which makes all our happiness and our suffering. So he's talking here about the inescapable fact that we have this experience of inwardness. You can say that everything is physical, everything is material in its origin, but you cannot explain why we feel inly. How it is that this occurred. So it is inside, in our inner experience, that all our values originate in how we interpret the cosmos. That's where it becomes important. And we don't need a philosopher to point us inside. We can simply close our eyes and feel and find our way back and eventuate in the precincts of the soul. The whole problem of life resolves itself into this one question. What are we to do with the soul and nature set face to face with each other? We who have as one side of our existence this nature, this personal and cosmic activity, which tries to impress itself upon the soul, to possess, control, determine it, and as the other side, this soul which feels that in some mysterious way it has a freedom, a control over itself, a responsibility for what it is and does, and tries therefore to turn upon nature, its own and the world's, and to control, possess, enjoy, or even, it may be, reject and escape from her. In order to answer that question, we have to know. To know what the soul can do, to know what it can do with itself, to know, too, what it can do with nature and the world. So, for Sri Aurobindo, knowledge, then, is not merely pure and essential. It is practical and aimed at sovereign self-control and expression. The whole of human philosophy, religion, science, is really nothing but an attempt to get at the right data upon which it will be possible to answer the question and solve, as satisfactorily as our knowledge will allow, the problem of our existence. The hope of a complete escape from our present strife with and subjection to our lower and troubled nature and existence arises when we perceive what religion and philosophy affirm, but modern thought has tried to deny, that there are two poises of our soul existence, a lower, troubled, and subjected, a higher, supreme, untroubled, and sovereign, one vibrant in mind, the other tranquil in spirit. This, of course, summons forth the image of the two birds, Vedic, Upanishadic, also found in the Gita, the two birds who sit on a common tree, the tree of nature, the tree of the world. And one bird sits above and watches his fellow. The fellow on the branch below eats the sweet and the bitter fruit. Eating the sweet has the experience of delight. Eating the bitter has the experience of sorrow and becomes dejected and feels perplexed by the world. But when he glances up and sees the other bird, he remembers what is his nature. Well, these are not two. These are one. This is the high self. This is the self embedded in, but not destroyed by, immersion and experience in the cosmos. It is possible to awaken and to be jubilantly, spiritually aware while being a full and active member of the universe. That tree of the cosmos, whose roots are above and branches are below, it's our natural home. The hope, not only of an escape, but of a completely satisfying and victorious solution comes when we perceive what some religions and philosophies affirm, but others seem to deny, that there is also, in the dual unity of soul and nature, a lower, an ordinary human status, and a higher, a divine. For it is in the divine alone that the conditions of the duality stand reversed. There, the soul becomes that which now it only struggles and aspires to be, master of its nature, free and by union with the divine possessor also of the world nature. Possessor also of the world nature. According to our idea of these possibilities will be the solution we shall attempt to realize. So this is the larger Vedanta which we find in the Gita, where Krishna, speaking as Purushottama, bids Arjuna rise to my nature, Madbhavam. Become like me, be like me. Rise out of mere Prakriti, which is the exoskeleton of my larger being, and come to my true divine nature. And there you begin to live from my supreme consciousness, in my supreme consciousness, one with nature, fulfilling your own soul in dynamism. You become the Jiva Bhuta again, seated in Paraprakriti, involved in mind, possessed by the ordinary phenomenon of mental thought, sensation, emotion, reception of the vital and physical impacts of the world, and mechanical reaction to them. The soul is subject to nature. Ah, then we've forgotten who we are. We ignore who we are, so we are in ignorance. Even its will and intelligence are determined by its mental nature, determined even more largely by the mental nature of its environment, which acts upon, subtly as well as overtly, and overcomes the individual mentality. Remember Sri Aurobindo's opening insight as he sat on the roof with Lele, and Lele said, "Watch, see the thoughts come. They don't come from within you, they come from outside." Yes, we are more thought than thinking, we are more lived than living, so if we put a stop to that nonsense, we no longer have to live chained to the appearances before us. Thus, its attempt to regulate, to control, to determine its own experience and action is pursued by an element of illusion, since when it thinks it is acting, it is really nature that is acting and determining all it thinks, wills, and does. If there were not this constant knowledge in it that it is, that it exists in itself, is not the body or life, but something other which at least receives and accepts the cosmic experience, if it does not determine it, it would be compelled in the end to suppose that nature is all and the soul an illusion. This is the conclusion modern materialism affirms, and to that nihilistic Buddhism arrived. The Sankhyas, perceiving the dilemma, solved it by saying that the soul, in fact, only mirrors nature's determinations and itself determines nothing, is not the Lord, but can, by refusing to mirror them, fall back into eternal immobility and peace. We won't hear try to unravel the deep connection between Sankhya and Buddhism. Let it go for the moment. But what Sri Aurobindo is presenting is, of course, not his view. There are two. The other solutions, which arrive at the same practical conclusion, but from the other end, the spiritual, for they affirm either that nature is an illusion, or that both the soul and nature are impermanent, and they point us to a state beyond in which their duality has no existence. Either they cease by the extinction of both in something permanent and ineffable, or their discordances end by the exclusion of the active principle altogether. So we are erased in the eternal one, I guess, or the non-entity, or we dissolve because we don't really exist in the beginning. So we can choose either Mayavada or Buddhism here. We're going to take your order. I don't see any orders. Though they do not satisfy humanity's larger hope and deep-seated impulse and aspiration, these are valid solutions so far as they go. For they arrive at an absolute in itself, Brahman, or at the separate absolute of the soul, even if they reject the many rapturous infinities of the Absolute, which the true possession of nature by the soul in its divine existence offers to the eternal seeker in man. Now we're leaving set aside for the moment the rest of the richness of the Indian tradition. We're not talking about the Tantra and how they aimed at the synthesis of spirit and nature. We'll come to that. Uplifted into the spirit, the soul is no longer subject to nature. So if we arrive at the Atman and dissolve into that oneness, the soul is content in that abstraction. It is above this mental activity. It may be above it in detachment and aloofness, udasina, seated above and indifferent, or attracted by and lost in the absorbing peace or bliss of its undifferentiated, its concentrated spiritual experience of itself. We must then transcend by a complete renunciation of nature and cosmic existence, not conquer by a divine and sovereign possession. So we transcend, we go back to that thing which is timeless and spaceless and above. But we don't possess here. Remember the Isha Upanishad. All this is for the habitation of the Lord. But the spirit, the divine, is not only above nature, it is master of nature and cosmos. Isha, Purushottama. The soul, rising into its spiritual poise, must at least be capable of the same mastery by its unity with the divine. So we can step out of the mutability in which we're typically enmeshed, the Kshara Purusha, and yes, reach the Akshara Purusha in which we're one with the Atman and blank out to the world. But we can also rise beyond the Akshara Purusha and arrive at Purushottama, the Uttama Purusha, the Supreme Purusha, where spirit and nature are one. And that is what gives us mastery. It must be capable of controlling its own nature, not only in calm or by forcing it to repose, but with a sovereign control of its play and activity. So this is where the Bhagavad Gita, at least by implication, and Tantra Yoga by outright definition, and the Integral Yoga by inherent claim, point us to bring spirit and nature back together again so that they are one. So, we're going to put a bookmark there and take up the rest of the chapter next week. This is a short passage from Savitri. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. We begin on page 44. Thus came his soul's release from ignorance, his mind and body's first spiritual change. A wide God knowledge poured down from above, a new world knowledge broadened from within. His daily thoughts looked up to the true and one, his commonest doings welled from an inner light. Awakened to the lines that nature hides, attuned to her movements that exceed our ken, he grew one with a covert universe. His grasp surprised her mightiest energy's springs. He spoke with the unknown guardians of the worlds. Forms he descried, our mortal eyes see not. His wide eyes bodied viewless entities. He saw the cosmic forces at their work and felt the occult impulse behind man's will. Time's secrets were to him an oft-read book. The records of the future and the past outlined their excerpts on the etheric page. One and harmonious by the Maker's skill, the human in him paced with the divine. His acts betrayed not the interior flame. This forged the greatness of his front to earth. A genius heightened in his body's cells that knew the meaning of his fate-hedged works, akin to the march of unaccomplished powers beyond life's arc in spirit's immensities. Apart he lived in his mind's solitude, a demigod shaping the lives of men, one soul's ambition lifted up the race. A power worked, but none knew whence it came. The universal strengths were linked with his, filling Earth's smallness with their boundless breaths. He drew the energies that transmute an age. Immeasurable by the common look, he made great dreams a mold for coming things, and cast his deeds like bronze to front the years. His walk through time outstripped the human stride. Lonely his days and splendid like the sun. End of Canto 3. Bonne année, Happy New Year. 2021 has come upon you. Namaste, Jai Ma.